This is Tony Noland from the fiction blog Landless at www.tonynoland.com, and you are listening to the Masters of Horror on Shadowcast Audio.
ShadowcastAudio.com presents The Masters of Horror, the anthology. Welcome to a world hidden behind the blinds of reality. A landscape waiting to be molded into a thing of pain and torture. This anthology is not for the faint-hearted. The ideas, themes, and disturbing images portrayed within will send your brain into overdrive on the road to madness. This book is guaranteed to rob you of sleep at night and bring you the nightmares you've most feared. You've been warned. Angel Lee McCoy writes short fiction that pushes the boundaries of the imagination. Her stories fall into two primary categories, horror and dark fantasy. She may look mild-mannered, but she doesn't shy away from the blackest of subjects. Learn more at angelmccoy.com. Recently, her fiction has appeared in the anthologies Ravens in the Library, Vile Things, Extreme Deviations of Horror, and Cobalt City Christmas. In addition, she has published stories in the print magazine Sinister Tales and Revenant magazine. During the day, she's a writer, game designer at ArenaNet, where she is part of a vast team effort to create Guild Wars 2. At night, she serves as head editor for WileyWriters.com. And now her story, The Barnes Family Reunion, read by Jason Warden. The Barnes Family Reunion by Angel Lee McCoy. "Hanging wouldn't be so bad," said my cousin Wolf. "I read in a book that if your neck doesn't break, the rope cuts off the blood to your brain. People think you die because you can't breathe. But the truth is, you die because your brain can't get any blood. You pass out pretty quick, too, so it doesn't hurt for long. The trouble is, it makes your face poochy and blue, and your tongue sticks out. So much for leaving a good-looking corpse. Though I suppose it's better than blowing off your face with a shotgun." Wolf's brother had used a shotgun. He was a mess. My dad remarried. The wedding took place in our backyard, a year to the day after my mother went away on my 5th birthday. Every year my stepmother hosted a family reunion on the date. She made coleslaw, potato salad, jello salad, and fruit trays. She baked oatmeal raisin cookies, sugar cookies, and pies, and she decorated everything with happy anniversary banners. The invitation said, "It's our anniversary," and were signed Robert, Cindy, and Jacob in my stepmother's handwriting. The entire Barnes family showed up to celebrate the anniversary of their wedding, of my birth, and of my real mother's absence. No one ever mentioned my mom, not if I was in earshot, but they'd cast sympathetic looks at me while they talked behind their hands. Most of them thought she'd run off. My dad mingled, stoic as a fence post, nodding and shaking hands. He worked at the paper factory, hefting boxes of paper like they were pillows. His upper arms bulged inside his shirt sleeves. He had a flat-top haircut that he imposed on me as well. He rarely spoke, and I can't remember a time when he didn't have a beer close at hand, unless he was on his way to get one. On those anniversaries, once the adults were too trash to come looking for me, I'd slip away to my room and bring out the scrapbook I kept hidden deep in my closet. I look at the happy pictures and remember my less than happy last hours with my mom. It was my 4th birthday. She was yelling at him. She was angry. She said she was leaving. My dad just stood there, not saying anything, not doing anything, until he quietly took a handful of her hair and pushed her head down into the dishwater. He held her there until she was quiet, too. Every year, at the anniversary party, just before the barbecued meat was ready, my stepmother would waddle over to stand at the end of the picnic table in the backyard, push her bleach-permed curls out of her face, raise a beer bottle to the crowd of relatives, and deliver her speech. It always began, "If y'all will indulge me for a minute." Her southern lilt came out when she was speaking in public, as if she had suddenly become dainty. Conversations halted when she started her speech. Everyone knew it was the precursor to the serving of the food. "Thank you for coming to help Rob and me celebrate our anniversary. On the day we got married, we were blessed, Lord knows why, because we both made terrible mistakes before that. And everyone laughed. But God saw fit to grant us a miracle. He gave us a second chance at happiness. They'd kiss, and the gathered on the lawn would cheer, raise their beers, and salute, and drink. By that time, most of them were half lit. Oh, my stepmother would add, and it's Jacob's birthday. She'd search the crowd for me and blow me a kiss when she found me. When I was 9, she blew me that kiss, and I flipped her off. My dad came after me. Stop right there, he growled when I turned to flee. You run, and it'll be twice as bad when I catch up with you. He had to dig for it in my fist, but he got a hold of my finger and he bent it all the way back. I heard it pop through crashing pain. Okay, everybody, my stepmother said, white-faced, as my dad dragged me to the kids' table and sat me on the bench. The burgers are coming off the grill. Get you a plate and don't forget to take a big helping of Marcy's potato salad. She's outdone herself this year. You don't get up from there until I say you can, my dad said. Questions of, what did he do, rippled through the crowd, and, you didn't see? He flipped Cindy the bird. They laughed. Serving spoons clanked against bowls. Someone peeled the plastic wrap off Marcy's potato salad. Little shit, I reckon you won't do that again. I never did that again. At the anniversary 2 years later, I was 11, and I made him mad again. I took my plate of food and sat beneath the old apple tree in the far corner of the yard. The tree's branches dappled the sunlight and whispered in the breeze. The sweet, mushy aroma of rotten apples brought back memories of my mom's applesauce and apple butter, of the steam rising off the pan where she was boiling the apple slices, of how she looked standing there, sweating in the heat of the kitchen, of her smile, of her touch. I knew my dad hated it when I sat there. The moment he saw me, he came at me, grabbed me by the arm, and lifted me to my feet. My plate of food went flying, my hamburger exploded, coleslaw, pickle relish, and ketchup splashed across the splotchy grass. He wrenched my arm, put his hard, reddened face close to mine, and said, "What did I tell you about sitting under this tree?" He'd told me not to do it, because he knew I knew. I'd been sitting on the spot where he'd buried my mother. I'd done it on purpose. It was worth the split lip. On their 8th wedding anniversary, my 13th birthday, the 9th anniversary of my mother's death, my 13-year-old cousin Wolf found his way up to my room. He stood in the doorway dressed in black jeans and an old leather jacket that was too big for him and too heavy for the summer's day, and he said, "Happy birthday." He pulled a dirt-encrusted marble out of his pocket and tossed it to me. "This is for you." The marble had a streak of rusty red inside, a nosebleed captured in amber. It was a shooter, not just any old marble. "I was going to keep it for myself," he said. "I found it down at the park. But since it's your birthday and all, well, I reckon I found it for you." He stepped into my room. "Nice ceiling fan," he said. "You know, if a guy were to put it on high and line himself up just right, on a ladder or something, he could stick his head in and have it hit him in the temple. It'd kill him quick if he did it right. Trouble is, the chances of timing it just perfect, on purpose, are pretty damn slim. People die that way by accident all the time, though. Funny, don't you think?" Next to Wolf, I was the all-American boy, with my flat top, striped shirt, and Levi jeans. My wardrobe never varied much. Purchased by my stepmother, pieces replaced as I wore them out or grew out of them, always practical. Whereas I was beige on the outside and black on the inside, Wolf was black throughout. We became inseparable. The summer following my 14th birthday, Wolf and I went to the county fair. We took a pass through the 4-H barn. We strolled between the grunting, stinking pigs and pens. Hay and mud clung to our sneakers, and Wolf, pinching his nose against the stench, said, nasal and squeaky, "I read in a book that pigs will eat anything you put in front of them, even people." The pigs watched us with their beady eyes. They stuck their filthy snouts through the bars at us, sniffing and grunting. Their ears pricked up as we approached, and they lifted their matted heads. Wolf commented, "I suppose if a guy didn't have any starving dogs around, he could always throw himself in the pen with the starving pigs, and they'd eat him to death." He swatted at a biting fly. Outside the barn, we stood looking at the rides. "What do you want to do now?" Wolf asked, but before I could answer, he said, "Let's ride the Ferris wheel." And so we did. Sitting in the swinging metal car high over the fairgrounds, we watched the people get smaller and smaller, and then bigger and bigger, and smaller and bigger, smaller. And when the ride stopped, with us at the very top, Wolf said, "We're 48 meters up. That's 144 feet. That's like 15 stories or something. You'd think that a guy who jumped from here would sure as hell be dead, but it ain't always so. I read in a book where this one guy jumped off a Ferris wheel and walked away because he landed on sand. Wolf leaned out over the lap bar to look down, and the metal basket pitched forward. I said, "My great uncle was sliding down the balcony in my great-great-grandpa's house, and he fell off. He fell 20 feet or something. He died, cracked his head right open." "That's what I'm talking about," Wolf replied. The Ferris wheel jerked as it started up again and our car rocked. Wolf was thrown back into his seat. I told him, "Everybody said it had to have been an accident. He was only 14. "We're 14? "Yeah." Wolf and I gorged ourselves on cotton candy and both fell asleep in our parents' station wagon on the way home. They dropped me at my house and waited until I'd gone inside. My stepmother hated dirt in her house, and she hated worse having dirty shoes in the front entrance, the visitor's entrance. My shoes had mud caked in the grooves and soles halfway up the sides. I'd come in through the front door half asleep and half comatose with sugar overload. I leaned against the wall and began to take off a shoe. My stepmother began to shriek, "Look at you, you stupid son of a bitch! What have I told you? Not in my house! Holy Jesus, you smell like shit! Get out!" She tried to push me out the back door. I had one shoe on and one half off. She shoved. I stepped on my own shoelace and lurched to the side. My arm slammed into the door jamb. It hurt. "Wait a minute," I cried. "Let me get my..." But she just gave me another shove, both hands on my chest. "Get out of my house!" Her voice had risen even higher and louder. "Stop shoving me, you stupid bitch!" I screamed at her. "What'd you call me?" She shoved me again, and this time I raised my arm to swipe her hands away from me. My forearm came up under her chin hard enough to make her teeth clack together and her head snap back. "You hit me!" She held her jaw, eyes wild with fury. "What's going on?" My dad was coming down the back hallway. "I can't deal with him anymore." My stepmother slammed the door in my face and threw the deadbolt. I stood there fuming, staring at the door. One shoe in my hand, I hit the door with the shoe. Pig shit and mud splattered across it. I hit it again and again. The neighbor's porch light came on. My dad didn't lose control often, but when he did, he was unpredictable and as deadly as a cobra. I knew that about him, but I was too angry to be quiet. When he came after me, I egged him on. Some might say I had a death wish. "It had to have been an accident," they'd say. "He was only 14. Wolf lived another 6 months before he made his first real attempt. Later, he described it as his trial run. In the middle of the night, while his parents were sleeping, he went out to the garage, started up the station wagon, and then lay down in the back with his hands crossed on his chest. His dad found him. He was unconscious, barely breathing, but not dead. He spent a couple of months in hospitals after that. First one to fix his body, then one to fix his mind. "You know," said Wolf, speaking to no one in particular, "if it wasn't for that horrible taste, the exhaust, you know, that'd be a sweet way to go. But that smell gets in your nose and your mouth, and it's hard not to cough. I thought for sure I was going to hurl, and no guy wants to be found with chunks all over him." That same year, my dad's youngest brother died with his head in the gas oven. Wolf was 16, and he had just gotten his driver's license when he turned goth. He listened to Bauhaus songs like Bela Lugosi's Dead, and Susie and the Banshees, The Ghosts in You. Black became his wardrobe. Wolf wrote poetry with lines like, "I am dead and gone, and it won't be long." He read aloud the poetry of Keats and Poe and Baudelaire's Les Fleurs du Mal in English and in his burgeoning French. "C'est l'ennui." "I've got a big ennui," Wolf said. He was translating the introduction of Les Fleurs du Mal. His eyes brimming with involuntary tear, he dreams of gallows while he smokes his hookah. You know him, reader, this delicate monster, hypocritical reader, my kindred spirit, my brother, Wolf nodded. My grandpa on my dad's side murdered my grandma with an axe. He hacked off her limbs, then he cleaned everything up. He wrapped grandma in a sheet and stuffed her in the laundry tub. Then he sat down on her and drew a kitchen knife across his own neck. When he heard about it, Wolf said, "Hey! You got your murder in my suicide. Hey, you got your suicide in my murder. Two great tastes that taste great together." Later, he also said, "Sometimes I think a guy just doesn't want to go alone." A few months later, Wolf's dad, my uncle, drove the station wagon over the median into oncoming traffic. He He took three others with him when he died, including Wolf's mother, my Aunt Marcy of potato salad fame. I'd often wished that my uncle had been my dad. When it came right down to it, he'd been an accomplice like the others. He'd watched, maybe even laughed. He'd never questioned. He'd been a Barnes through and through. He'd called my dad one night, a few weeks before he killed himself. "Robert," he said, "is there anything I should know? Anything you want to tell me about Jacob?" My dad hadn't confessed anything. Of course, I don't know what I'd have done if he had. It might have changed everything. I had been telling my uncle the truth in midnight whispers that seeped into his dreams. He'd started questioning then, and the answers had withered his soul until he had nothing left. "The majority of people's lives are absurd," Wolf told his psychiatrist. "We're like ants performing the same task day in and day out. We delude ourselves into thinking that what we do serves a greater purpose. But the world of the living has no greater purpose. It is the ultimate in perpetual motion and faux progress." Wolf's second attempt was after his parents died. He finished off an entire bottle of Paxil and proceeded to run around the neighborhood in a state of delirium, in his underwear, until his muscles seized up on him, and he collapsed on the neighbor's lawn with police and rescue surrounding him. He'd hunched, gagged, and puked a slick spew of milk, pills, and Pop-Tarts. "Poison," Wolf said later, "is not the way to go. My stepmother put poison in the brownies she'd baked for dessert. She knew my dad loved her brownies. Over the years, my whispers to her had been merciless. I told her time and again how wonderful my mom had been and how much I had loved her. I told her about her husband, my dad, the murderer, and what he'd done to my mom. I told her what he'd done to me and how he'd lied to her about where I'd gone. I wasn't living with relatives. There were no other relatives. Not anymore. She began to fear my dad, to jump when he entered the room, to take extra care not to upset him. I was patient with her. I fed her fears. I made her realize how unimportant she was. I brought her to the brink of her own nothingness, and I made sure that when she decided she was ready to go, she took my dad with her. In her final days, she tried to go about her business as usual, but my whispers threw her off kilter. While my dad was at work, she dug through his drawers and his boxes in the garage looking for paperwork or a phone number scribbled on a scrap, anything she could use to track me down and prove to herself that I wasn't dead. Whereas before, she'd been content to accept my father's explanations at face value. My whispers had made her obsessed with finding evidence, a clue to vindicate or convict him. She found me, right where I told her I'd be, in the garden, deeper than flowers required. The shovel snagged an arm bone, and she knew what it was. She dug until she unearthed my shoe, the one I'd lost, the one he'd tossed in on my chest, the one encrusted with pigsty mud. She couldn't touch it. At first, she couldn't look at it. It took her a while, but I encouraged her. I was patient. I waited. I whispered. I coaxed. She was crying, the tears streaming down her face and her whole body shaking, but I knew she wasn't sad. She was scared. She covered me back up and then went inside, showered and changed. That afternoon, she baked the brownies. My dad, ever the stoic, ate in silence. It didn't take long for the poison to affect him. He rubbed his hands over his face, lightly at first, then more harshly. He put his head in one hand and let the other flop onto the table. "I ain't right," he said, but his tongue had gone numb. I stayed nearby, watching. I'd never dared whisper to him. Even after everything, I was still afraid of him. But then, with his stomach beginning to heave against the poison, I found the courage to say what I had always wanted to say. I leaned in close, and I whispered, "I hate you." "What'd you do, Cindy?" he asked, chin down, eyes turned up so that his whites were thick pools beneath the black pupils. My stepmother just sat there with a perfect brownie, untouched on the plate in front of her, vanilla ice cream melting across it. My dad doubled over, leaning on the table. He got up on his feet. He stumbled toward the telephone. He wasn't ready to go. He was going to fight it the whole way, just as I hoped he would. My stepmother had taken the upstairs phone off the hook, a stroke of murderous brilliance, if I do say so myself. I heard the rhythm of my dad's breathing change as he listened to death on the phone line. He dropped the receiver and clutched his chest. When the convulsions started, they started violent. He fell to the floor, body quaking. The convulsions eased into shivering. His breathing, too, went from ragged to slow. Too slow. His face took on the same lax, stoic expression he'd always wore, but his eyes revealed the pain caused by the fire in his belly. "See you in hell, Robert," my stepmother said and dug her fork into the brownie. Despite our predictions to the contrary, Wolf survived high school. He failed P.E. with pride, but got straight A's in reading, writing, and arithmetic. At the end of it, he was accepted to MIT and entered the philosophy program. In college, Wolf uncovered a whole new layer of knowledge to feed his obsessions. He studied rationalism, nihilism, and existentialism. He read Plato, Descartes, and Nietzsche. It was Nietzsche who said, "That which does not destroy us makes us stronger," to which Wolf added, "And then we die." He dove into the works of the master philosophers. He sat in coffee shops with books piled around him, and I sat there with him, listening to him talk and reading over his shoulder. Wolf had big ideas, and everything our other family members might have cared about paled in comparison. He was finding worlds in grains of sand. I whispered the truth to Wolf. He heard me better than anyone. He knew I was there, telling him things. He investigated, and he involved the police. They found my mom, and they found me. Toward the end of junior year in college, Wolf made his third and final attempt. He stayed in his dorm room in silent meditation for a whole day. When he finally spoke, he said, "I am the last Barnes. Everyone else is gone." He said, "Are you here, Jacob?" "I'm ready." "You don't understand," I whispered to him. "You're the one who lives." "Our genes imprison us," he murmured, as much to himself as to me. He sat cross-legged on the flat, hard twin bed. He says, "All the great philosophers are saying the same thing," voicing his thoughts aloud, giving them substance. "We have to split open the man to release the god trapped inside. It's Dadaism, turning flesh and blood into energy and light, into the flow of atoms and the spark of energy that we are. It's Nietzsche's Superman. It's Augustine's City of God, whose gates are shut to those who cling to the City of Man." I told him, "You're different from the others. You're not nothing." Wolf's brown eyes shone as if he knew the secret of the universe. Camus said that the only truly serious philosophical problem is suicide. He smiled, and I have to agree with him. He opened his book bag and took out the paper he'd been working on for weeks or decades. The title read, "A Philosophy of Life and Death." The author was listed as Wolf Elias Barnes, and it was dedicated to Jacob Barnes, me. "It's my magnum opus," Wolf said. "I wrote it for you, Jacob, because of you. I never forgot you." He dipped his hand back into the book bag and drew out a gun. He put the barrel to his head, just behind his ear. "Don't," I whispered. But he didn't hear me. My magic worked over time. Whispers in the dark, suggestions from the shadows, reminders of sin and sorrow. Those were my tools. I had no power in the immediacy of the moment. Wolf's eyes, lit by the golden light of late afternoon, didn't waver. He looked upward into infinity and held his breath. His mouth curled up at the corners and twitched in anticipation. This has been a presentation of ShadowcastAudio.com and is produced under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License. Copy it, share it, pimp it all you want. Just don't try to sell it or change it. We keep this going through you, the listener. For the duration of the Masters of Horror podcast, all who make donations to ShadowcastAudio.com will receive an ebook copy of the Masters of Horror. Just specify which format you would like. In addition, you'll also be entered to win a print version signed by myself, which will be given away at the end of the last episode. The music for the podcast is an original piece done specifically for the Masters of Horror by Christopher Carlson. Find more great selections at ChristopherCarlson.com. Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Tony Noland from the fiction blog Landless at www.tonynoland.com. Every Friday, I post an original piece of flash fiction to my website for you to read and comment on. I write horror, science fiction, fantasy, and literary fiction. It's all part of the Friday Flash movement, which lets readers like you find writers like me. Just go to Twitter and look for the hashtag #FridayFlash. You'll see links to dozens and dozens of different author stories, including mine. Friday Flash. It happens on Twitter every week. This is Tony Noland. See you on Friday.